Welcome to the Children's Book Author Podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor Page. If you write for children, or it's always been your dream to, you're in the right place. As the Children's Book Author, I'm on a quest to discover everything there is about writing, publishing, and marketing children's books, as well as how to supercharge my creativity, skyrocket my productivity, and absolutely everything else there is to know about how to be the best, so you can be too. Join me as I interview fabulous guests and become the children's book author. Welcome back to another episode of the Children's Book Author Podcast with me, your host, Eleanor Page. What have I been up to lately? I have been writing manically, working on The Magician's Academy, which is the third book in The Magician's middle grade series. And I'm having so much fun crafting surprises. That's what I want to say, surprises. I hope that part of my thing is good enough twists and surprises. I'm sure I could go better with them. But that's sort of one of the things that I've been working on behind the scenes, trying to get those surprises in, because there's nothing like surprising children with, oh, no. Sometimes, of course, they're going to think those surprises are bad surprises or corny, or they didn't like them. Like, spoiler alert, when in book one, the friend became the foe. I won't say more than that. And there were a lot of kids that were very mad that I did that. They write to me genuinely, which is, hey, probably a good thing. If they're passionate enough to write, then it must have stirred something in them. But that's really where I've been putting my efforts. I have finally sat down and begun to think up some ideas of, oh, I need a drum roll. I wish I had special effects. How or what I could do on a school visit. Yes, yes. And after today's fantastic interview with Mary Anastasiou, who leads the creative team at indie publisher Larrikin House, oh, she says you have to get out there and brand yourself. And part of branding is getting your face seen. And who do you need to get your face seen by? Well, you need to get your face seen by the people who read your books. And who reads the books? Well, the children read the books. And while I can't fly to America right now, I can actually probably reach out to some schools locally, or maybe even do Zoom visits. In any case, I'm finally doing something about it. I will update you as I go. Well, today's interview, I won't keep you long today. There isn't too much that I want to say. Today's interview is all about author branding and trad publishing. So you're going to love that. Hey, you know, did it make me go, maybe I should trad publish something one day? A little bit. It made me curious, 100%. I wouldn't be closed off to it. So keep an open mind. Remember that each of your books is a new book baby, and you are allowed to self-publish something, trad-publish something, whatever's required to get your books into the world. And trad-publishing is a really fantastic way to do it. Is it easy? You will learn from this interview that not necessarily so, but then what is easy? Nothing in life is easy. All things require hard work and dedication and passion. And I would like to add, staying power. I have learned over the years in every career I've ever done, and it makes it sound like I have a lot of careers, I have had a lot of careers, that if you stay with something long enough, you will eventually make it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's just been my personal experience, but it is what I've experienced. I see people drop off and I stay there and eventually I make it. So what does make it look like? Well, you know, that's a personal definition, isn't it? Is it a certain amount of money you want to make it to? Is it a certain amount of fame? Is it just getting a book published and out into the world and that's considered making it? I think at the end of the day, making it means, for me, that you have a career that you can get up to every day and that you can continue to do and that you are somewhat reimbursed for it and that you're loving and enjoying it. That's what I see as success. And most of the careers that I've started, being a self-starter. I don't start off like that. So when I started off in counseling for several years, maybe 5 years, I made no money, none, zero, zilch. And yet I kept doing it. And as I said, a lot of other people dropped off, but I kept doing it until eventually I did start making money. And then eventually I started making very good money and publishing exactly the same experience. Now, unfortunately, when the interview was recorded, I must have been using the wrong microphone. So I do sound terrible in contrast to Mary's amazing suave and soothe vocals. She has the most incredible voice. I reckon you'll just listen back to the podcast just for her voice. And my voice sounds even worse than usual. So I apologize in advance for that. There wasn't much that I did try to improve my audio a little bit. And so hopefully I did improve it and didn't make it worse. But luckily I don't talk too much. It is mostly Mary. So in advance, a warning and an apology that my audio this week is not the best. Get encouraged. Take your pen and paper out because I'm sure you're going to take lots of notes from listening to Mary, and enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to the Children's Book Author Podcast with me, your host, Eleanor Page. And, well, you know, I normally say lots and lots of specials, how special my guest is, but I'm just going to bypass special today and go straight to amazing. I have Mary Anastasiou with me today, and I don't often do this, but I'm going to read this bio because it's so bloody good it needs to be read word for word. So, Mary, a self-confessed chocoholic, pluviophile, a lover of all things kidlit, Mary writes books that she hopes will engage, inspire, and empower little people on their journey to becoming big people. With 30 years of marketing and design experience, Mary now heads the creative team at indie publisher Larrikin House, responsible for the creation of more than 60 Larrikin titles. Mary works exclusively with authors and illustrators to create books that she hopes will one day become classics. Author of the much-loved I Wanna Be series, her latest title, I Want to Be a Sports Star, was shortlisted for the Speech Pathology Book of the Year Awards in 2022. And with three new titles set for release in 2023, Jimmy Bottoms, Julia Squeezer, I love those titles, and The Art of Making Friends, Mary is set to continue making her own kidlit dreams come true. A frequent guest assessor for both Kidlit Vic and CYA, Mary loves nothing more than to help others achieve their publishing dreams. And she's come on the show today to help me and to help you. So welcome to the show, Mary.
That's a bloody long bio. Like, seriously.
It's good, though. I don't normally read it, but I had to.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's yeah. Maybe I need to go back and edit it a bit. People do say I talk too much, so there you go.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on my tiny little baby podcast.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to see you again.
We did know each other from another lifetime, funnily enough, and we were like, hold on, I know you from somewhere. And here we are. So tell me a bit about how you began on this whole journey. Like, where did it start for you?
I've been writing stories my whole life, really. I've been in marketing and advertising for a really long time, so I've written commercial copy for advertisements and campaigns, advertising campaigns and things like that for nearly 30 years. And then Luke came along, and that was in, 2008, a long time ago. And like most parents, you start making up stories in your head at bedtimes, and you start reading books and doing things like that. And I'd always had ideas in my head for a particular series of stories. So Rockstar and Movie Star had been in my head for a really, really long time. And he started to hear me continuously telling people that all I wanted to do was sit on a lounge chair on an island somewhere drinking daiquiris and writing kids' stories, right? And I think one day when he was about 6 years old, he just got sick of me saying it, and he just looked at me and he said, "When are you going to make your dream come true, Mum?" it was at that point that I had a decision to make, because there was an opportunity to teach him that if you really believe in something, you can work hard and make it happen. So rock star and movie star kind of happened relatively quickly. And then Rockstar was my very first book, and that was a self-publishing journey. That's kind of where it started. Where it's ended up is completely different to where it started, but yeah, that's where it started.
Wow. So you, I love that he was kind of like your trigger for stop talking about it, get up and do it. Kids are so amazing like that.
Completely. It was just one of those things that it was just, you know, you look at this 6-year-old who's obviously sick of hearing you saying the same thing over and over again. So to have him say, just do it, like stop talking about it and just do it, that was a really great motivator for me, and it was a really great opportunity for me to kind of really put my money where my mouth is.
Yeah, and then how did you go from like publishing that book yourself to then having that same book, is that right? Traditionally published, and then you ending up working in traditional publishing. Like what happened in between?
I went the self-publishing route, did all of the things that I needed to do. So did, you know, I've got a background in marketing, so I knew what I needed to do from a marketing perspective, and did all of those things, and did PR and editorial and self-promotion, and collaborated with, you know, lots of different people, book reviewers and mummy influencers and bloggers and things. And because I was running a business and raising a child on my own, I didn't really have a lot of time to kind of focus on doing things like school visits and appearances and things like that. So it got to a point where I didn't have, and you would know because through your books as well, I didn't have an active distribution channel. So as a self-published author, it's really difficult to find distributors who'll take your books, because there's all sorts of costs that are involved with that and so on and so forth. And then getting it into bookstores was another. I had to have a boot full of books in the back of my car so that every time I came across a bookstore, I could walk in and say, hey, I've got these titles, would you be interested in stocking them? And that in itself can be really disheartening. I mean, you know what that's like. I got to a point where I'd kind of exhausted all avenues, didn't know what to do with them, and sort of just kind of left it, didn't do anything more with it. And then I think it would have been maybe six months to a year after I'd sort of dropped the ball, I got a message through LinkedIn from James Layton saying, hey, I've just come across this blog that you, or an interview that you'd done on a mummy blog, and I'm interested in talking to you about your books. And I went, okay. So we got onto a telephone call, and he said, look, you know, I'm starting Larrikin House and I'm interested in publishing Australian authors. And I saw your book and I'm interested in having a look at it. So I sent it through to him and he signed me for that one, and he signed me for Movie Star, and he signed me for a third, pretty much straight up, which was really exciting.
That's crazy exciting. Wow.
It was at that point where I'd kind of gone, yeah, well, I've done what I needed to do. That's it. If I only ever have one book in the world, then that's it, right? And then in terms of how I got involved with Larrikin House, I was a bit naughty. He sent me the contract and it had a logo on it, and I looked at him and I said, is that your logo? And he said, yeah. I said, no, sorry, that's not your logo. So I went away and redesigned the logo and developed the brand and came up with the smiley face and the yellow background and all that sort of stuff. And it kind of evolved from there. He then kind of said, okay, do you want to do the books? Like, can you just art direct all the books? I went, sure, no problem. You want me, I'm there. That's my favourite thing in the world to do. So I kind of fell into a dream job, really.
Oh, you really did. But, you know, what I'm hearing from what you're saying is that, yes, you fell into it, but you actually worked hard to get there. So, you know, what I'm hearing is incredible confidence in your own skills and ability, what I need more of. So I'm taking notes 100%. And also, you know, you are out there promoting those books in the most, you know, amazing ways that I heard you sort of mention. You know, you sort of did it really quickly, but I heard you say you're on mummy blogs and probably on a podcast. Well, now you've been on podcasts. So he didn't just, you know, stumble upon you. In other words, he would never have stumbled upon you if you hadn't have been out there doing those things. And then you're the one that said, hey, your logos could be better. So, you know, there's this part of you that puts yourself out there and actually believes in your skill and talent.
Well, seriously, don't get it twisted. If you spoke to him and he tells you the story, he would tell you that he never, ever reads mummy blogs, ever. He never reads a blog. He's never read a blog in his life. So how he ended up on this blog reading an article or an interview that I'd done with this person, no one will ever know. I think it's probably the universe conspiring to make things happen. And as far as telling him that his logo sucked, that's just me. Like I'm honest, right? I'm just going to say, you know, you're starting a business. You can't go out with a brand like that. Like there's no way. If you, you know, really want to make an impact and you really want to differentiate yourself from who's actually out there in the marketplace at the moment in terms of your competition, you really need to go out with a really professional look. And luckily enough, he likes dominant Greek chicks. So he kind of just went, yeah, all right, do it. Just do it. So the beginning of a very lovely relationship. So, you know, friendship in terms of, you know, working relationship. And he's just lots of fun. He's a bit of a card, a bit like me, which is good. So, yeah, it worked out really well.
What an incredible story. And so how long have you been there and what exactly do you do? Like the actual, tell me exactly what it looks like.
Okay, so Larrikin House has only been around for, I think this year is our third year. Don't quote me on that. I think it's third year. Essentially, in the beginning, I did everything from designing the website, doing all of the social media, all of their marketing collateral, anything that needed a Larrikin brand on it was me. In turn, also the design and production of all of their titles, so all of their books. I think about a year or so ago, I got like really busy and had to sort of pull back from a lot of the social media stuff and, you know, the marketing collateral and things. So now I just focus on producing the actual books for them. So what happens is that a manuscript lands on my desk, a black and white sheet of paper lands on my desk, and it then becomes my job to find the right illustrator to marry the narrative to an illustration style and to work closely with both the author and the illustrator to get illustrations done. And then I do the design component, the production component, and the next time the Larrikin team see it is when it's in their hands, really. So
how do you do that? Like what do you look for in like an illustrator to match it to that text?
It's a bit of an intuitive thing, to be totally honest. I think the only thing that, like, if I could say to you that there was something specific that I look for in an illustrator, and I've had a lot of people ask me this, for me it's about the eyes, an illustrator who can actually really communicate emotion through eyes and through facial expression. That's the thing that draws me, because I think what happens is that people forget that 9 times out of 10, the kids that are reading these stories are either being read to or can't read themselves. So they rely on the visual narrative to express the story. So if you can convey expression in facial features or in physical characteristics or those kinds of things, then that's a really big draw card for me. But in terms of choosing the right illustrator, it's an intuitive thing. I kind of go, I don't know if many people do this, but when I read a manuscript, I see it in my head. It becomes a visual, like I get pictures in my head of what I think it's going to look like. Then what I do is I scour Instagram until I find someone that kind of fits that, the pictures that I've got in my head. Yeah, and I just reach out to them usually. So most of the illustrators that we've found have been through Instagram.
So Instagram's like really important for illustrators then?
I would say it's probably the most important tool that an illustrator can have. If their Instagram or online portfolio isn't reflective of the kind of work that they do, then they need to go back and reassess it and clean it up and make sure that they're showcasing the best work.
Mm-hmm, that's big. Okay, illustrators out there who are listening to this podcast, fix up your Instagram. 100%, get out there. What is it like working with an author and an illustrator? Because you're kind of like the project manager in a way, aren't you?
I'm kind of the conduit, really. So what happens is that the manuscript lands on my desk. I have a quick conversation with the author usually, and what happens is that I ask them for what we call illustrator notes. So if they've got any ideas or they've got a particular vision for, you know, a certain part of the story or those kind of things, we actually ask them to give us that information straight up. There's two ways that we do it. We either choose the illustrator and say, this is who we're using, or there might be two or three different ones that we're really interested in. And then what we do is we'll say to the author, this is the selection of illustrators. Is there anyone here that resonates for you? And we sometimes give them an option. That doesn't happen very often because it's usually the publishing house makes that decision whether the author likes it or not. It's a bit sad, but that's kind of how it works in the industry. So then I take the author's illustrator notes and combine them into a brief for the illustrator, including a pagination so they know which text goes on which pages and so on and so forth. And then the illustrator goes away and does some very, very rough pencil sketches of the pages. They send them back to us. We check them to make sure that we're happy with the visual direction. There's an opportunity to make changes at that point. Goes back to the illustrator. So there's maybe two rounds of changes that happen within, you know, the conceptual stage before we then give the illustrator final sign off and say go away and do all the colour illustrations and then send them back. And that process usually takes between 3 and 4 months.
I was going to say, how long does it take, right? 3 or 4 months.
From the time a manuscript is actually signed to the time you actually get a book in your hands, it's usually close to 12 months. It's a three to four month illustration process, a couple of weeks of production, and then another 3 to 4 months of actual print. Yeah, print and delivery.
And then how long is that book out in the world for? Does it have like a time limit or can it be out there forever?
Well, it depends on how many copies the publisher has initially produced. Normally it'll be out in the world for as long as they've got copies to actually sell. But in terms of a marketing window, if that's what you're asking me, because, you know, publishers have, you know, new titles coming through every month, right? So from an author's perspective and an illustrator's perspective, you've probably got a window of about 4 to 6 weeks of full-on marketing that you should be doing. And you should be doing it beforehand anyway in kind of the lead up to the launch of your book. But when your book is finally available and you've actually got copies in your hands, you've got between 6 to 8 weeks, I think, of, you know, actively pushing it before something new comes along and, you know, replaces what you've done. The very first few weeks is really important.
Yeah, right. And because I hear this all the time, people who are not published but say might be self-publishing, they'll often go, oh, do you know what? I've had enough of doing this. It's so much hard work. I'm going to get a traditional publishing deal so I don't have to market. I can just write. And I'm thinking, I don't think that's right. And I'm like, I need to ask someone this. Is that right? That's not right.
It's so wrong. What's interesting is I had a conversation with someone the other day who asked me a very similar question, and she actually made a really good point, which I have thought about it but never kind of articulated it in the way that she did, which was really lovely. So what authors don't realise is that a publishing company is actually investing in you, right? So if you think about the fact that the average picture book costs anywhere between 15 and 20 grand to actually produce, yeah? The publishing company will do whatever they can to get your book out into the market, to get it in front of the right hands, to get it in front of the right retailers, make sure that the distributor is doing the right thing. But from a marketing perspective, it has to be a collaborative effort. Like if you're not showing that you're willing to, you know, put your money where your mouth is or to literally do the physical activity, go to the schools and the book launches and all of those things, they need to know that you're actually going to be behind the book and do whatever you can to make sure that you make a loud noise about it, right? So, yeah.
So the publishing house, did I hear you say this or did I fill this in? A publishing house is investing in the author.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So they're investing in the author. They're not investing necessarily just in that one book.
Well, look, I think, well, yes, they're investing in the book and they're investing in the author. But when I say that they're investing in the author, they're investing in somebody who they believe will actually go out and actively promote their own books. Yeah?
That's really important. That's like...
What happens is if you can't demonstrate to a publishing company that you're actually able to do that or you're willing to do that, then they're less likely to sign, you know, anything else that you present to them, because you need to be able to demonstrate that you're actually working with them in a collaborative way to do as much for the promotion of your book as they're going to do.
That's so important. You know, I did hear the sentence one time that the publisher gets your book into the bookstore, but it's your responsibility to get that book out of the bookstore.
That's meaning, absolutely, you know, true.
Yeah. A lot of people don't see that. So that's amazing. You're really in partnership, and it's that partnership that's everything, is what I'm actually hearing.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think people underestimate the importance of it. I think the reality is that if you haven't built, and I've said this before, if you haven't built a tribe or an audience prior to the release of your book, then you're literally marketing to no one. If people don't know who you are in terms of your own personal brand, forget the book, yeah? If people aren't aware of Alana Page as an author or your individual personal brand and you release a book, they're going to go, yeah, and? So what? You've released a book, big deal. Or you release it and there's no active audience there ready and receptive to buying your book because they know nothing about you, let alone know where to buy it, right? My advice has always been to authors and illustrators who have just had a manuscript signed, the very first thing that you need to be doing is building your tribe.
How do we do this? Give me it all. I want it all, Mary. Don't hold back now. I've got here, actually, I read in an article this morning that the number one way to get more sales, la la la, is to build a magnetic author brand. And I was like, what a coincidence. I happen to be talking to someone who's an expert on this today.
Well, I don't know about an expert, but I do what I can. It's the fundamental thing of understanding that your books are consumer driven. You have to find people that want to buy your books. And the best way to do that is to, firstly, as I said, work on your own personal brand. Who are you? What style of writing do you do? Who's your target market? Who's your audience? Who is going to pick up your book and read it? Yeah. So from a social media point of view, focus on giving people an opportunity to get to know you as a person, as a writer, as a person, the things you like, the things that inspire you, the things that you do, those kinds of things. And then look for external opportunities to align yourself with people who mirror the same qualities as you. So whether it's, you know, a mummy blogger or whether it's an influencer or whether it's a podcast, whatever it is, as much activity as you possibly can to get your name as an author, illustrator out there is really important. And if that means organizing giveaways or doing collaborations of some sort or things like that that are actually going to improve your profile, then that's what I would suggest that you do from the very, very, very beginning.
And I think for me, I can only talk for me, part of the process, I think now I've been writing for maybe 6 years, is I wasn't sure what that identity was because I was sort of learning what is it that I write, what is it that differentiates me from, say, other authors, or not necessarily completely different, but what do I stand for? What's the kind of core messaging of, you know, most of my books? Is all that stuff important?
I think it's important from a communication point of view. You need to be consistent in whatever it is that you're actually putting out there into the world. You know what it's like. Social media is one of those things where, and I've said this before, you need to see a brand 7 times before somebody even remembers it, yeah? If you can find ways to be consistent in terms of the message that you're delivering or the visual aesthetic of what you're delivering and that's seen, you know, multiple times, people begin to recognize who you are, whether it's, you know, you could be posting about a book, you could be posting about, I'm not going to say the lunch that you had yesterday because I don't necessarily kind of recommend that you do that. But, you know, if there's a visual consistency or if there's a consistency in terms of the message that you're delivering, then that creates brand awareness, what we call brand awareness. And, yes, it is important from a communication point of view. So if you look at my social media, for example, my tagline is engage, inspire, empower. And it comes back to that idea of all I wanted to do was produce books that engaged little people on their journey to becoming big people, yeah, inspired people. So everything that I do has an element of that. So as a result of coming up with that tagline, you then do what we call content pillars, where you work out kinds of things that you could be posting from a content point of view. So education, inspiration, motivation, publicity, marketing. So you have a whole list of different content ideas, and then your marketing works around those things, which makes it a little bit easier.
Yes, it's kind of like knowing your core and then sort of like moving out from that space.
So rather than posting things randomly without any rhyme or reason, if you've got a series of content pillars and you know, for example, that this is what my model is, okay, today I'm going to do an engagement post. Tomorrow I'm going to do an inspirational post. The day after that I'm going to do some publicity. The day after that I might do something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And is social media still really important and relevant even for children's book authors, given that our audience isn't necessarily on social media, meaning kids themselves?
Their parents are. So, like, it's the parents. Like, the kids aren't going to be buying the book necessarily. It's a secondhand thing with kids. So when you're looking at kids, for example, to kind of promote your book, that's where you're looking at author visits and book signings and things like that, activities where kid-lit events and things like that, where you can get in front of kids and show them who you are and show them what you do and show them the books that you do. That's kind of a completely different area. Social media is absolutely important to an author and illustrator in terms of getting in front of the faces of the people that have got the money in their pockets. You know, I mean, that's probably a crude way of describing it, but it's true. That's your consumer base. If you can't reach them through social media, how else are you going to reach them? You're going to stand on the corner of the street and wave your book in the air and go, hey, guys, look, I've got this book, yeah? So, yeah, social media is absolutely very, very important.
Going back to the design, because there'll be a lot of people listening to this podcast who self-publish and manage their own visual identity and visual brand of their books. How do you know what's a good cover or not? Like, what are some of the things that are particularly important for kids' books?
From a production point of view, I would always recommend never do a white cover. Because we found from a production point of view that what happens to distributors is that they get bumped and they get knocked and they get smudged and, you know, so they get damaged in transit. So white books is probably not the best thing to do. But anything that's got like a really strong, powerful headline and something that's going to grab attention, bold colours are always really good. And it depends on what your genre is. If you're talking picture books, then it's got to be obviously an image that's really engaging, that's relevant to the narrative in the story and draws me enough to want to pick it up and read it, yeah? With junior fiction, it's a little bit different because, you know, there's so much competition on the shelves with junior fiction that it has to be something that's high impact. Again, that draws your attention, that really quickly demonstrates or conveys what it is that the narrative is about. So, yeah, just bold, bright, and it's really good design. You've got a really good design. Sometimes it doesn't have to be big text across the top. Sometimes it can be very small, delicate. It just depends on the actual story. The cover needs to be really reflective of what the story is actually about.
Right, the cover needs to be reflective of what the story is about. And typography, what I notice is you can actually tell a lot of self-published books because of their poor typography.
You can tell a lot about self-published books from their illustrations too. I think there's that old adage, you get what you pay for, right? So even from a self-publishing point of view, And maybe it's because I've had a marketing background and because I've, you know, done design for so long. Even from a self-publishing point of view, I knew from day dot that I was going to need to spend a lot of money to get a really good quality book. So there was no way that I was going to scrimp on an illustrator. The illustrations were really important to me. So, and the design was really important to me. So when I kind of started to seek out how to do that, I was lucky in that I came across Anil Tortop and her husband Ozan from Tadar Books, and she just blew me away. They run this really amazing website where they represent a whole bunch of illustrators, so you can go in and have a look at these illustration styles and they can then choose someone that you think, you know, would be perfect for your book. And then you pay a set fee to have your illustrations done, and it's not cheap by any means, but it's far better quality than something like Fiverr, if you know what I'm saying. So, yeah, they took over the design component and they did all of that sort of stuff. But, yes, typography is very important.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, really choosing professionals that are quality. They might not. I think somebody taught me this. There's three things. Time. I'm trying to remember them now. That's why I'm using my fingers. Time, cost, and speed. And they said you can't have all three. And actually after they told me that, I started paying attention, and this is actually true.
It's true. It's true. If you have one, the other two suffer. It's very – if you want speed, then you need to know that the quality is not going to be great. You know, if you want quality, then you need to know that the costs are going to be high. It's very simple. It's a very, very simple little math equation, but it's absolutely true.
In self-publishing, there are, I reckon you could write a book on the horror stories of working with illustrators, but, which negates what I just said, but that's often because they're hiring illustrators who aren't professional illustrators, right? So there's all sorts of dramas that I read in Facebook groups that happen all the time, like the illustrator vanishes off the face of the planet. They, halfway through the project, they really don't work hardly at all on that book. The characters are consistent, like they start to look different. I know you've said this, but it is actually so important to work with an illustrator who is a professional illustrator in some capacity, even if they're new, because I did have an interview with someone who likes to discover new talent, but there's a contract. That contract is really important.
As do I. I love finding new talent. And I think 80% of the illustrators that we've actually signed for Larrikin House had never done a picture book before. So they kind of came off the back of their Instagram page, and I was enamored by what they did and just reached out to them and said, can you do? But I think one of the other issues with self-publishing is that if you're a first-time author or, you know, have never self-published before, you don't really know the process anyway, yeah? And that's really important. The truth is there are a lot of people out there, a lot of illustrators out there that are more than willing to take advantage of people that are self-publishing for the very first time because they know that they actually don't know what they're supposed to be asking for. And unfortunately, there isn't anyone kind of in the middle, like a conduit sort of person, who can bridge that gap between, you know, the self-published author and an illustrator from a production point of view. So it's a steep learning curve for authors who are starting out for the very first time. The truth is, you know, with ChatGPTs and, you know, and electronics and all that sort of stuff, everybody thinks that they can write picture books, right? Or everybody thinks that they can write stories. And it's a long and tedious process. And once you've actually written something and you've invested that time and that emotion into producing that manuscript, why would you go and do something cheap like Fiverr? Like, why would you do that? That just doesn't compute to me. Like, I get that there's budgets. I get that you have to kind of stay within whatever money you've got and so on and so forth. But, again, it comes back to that idea of, you know, if you're going to brand something, brand it really well so that people actually recognize it and you're not embarrassed by it in 5 years. Think about it like that.
Yeah, that's a really good way to think of it.
You don't want to look back on something that you did 5 years ago and go, oh, my God, what was I thinking? Especially if you become really good at it and you become like a really proficient author and very well-known author, and then you look back at something that you did that was self-published 3 years ago or 4 years ago and you think, wow.
I do that now still.
Well, no, you don't.
I do. I have nightmares about some of my early books. I do.
The good thing about self-publishing, especially if you're doing it through someone like Ingram Spark, is that if you do feel like that 3 years down the track, you can always change the cover, right? You could just go, okay, this is a new edition. You can do that. That's not a problem. So you can always reinvent yourself along a page.
Can, I know, but it's so exhausting to reinvent yourself. You know me, I'm reinventing myself all the time. It's tiring. I've never, ever had anything traditionally published, I'm confessing on air, and people will often say to me, why is that? And be honest, I've never tried to. I'm a bit of a sort of self-starter. So, you know, like in my mind, it's kind of like, oh, I've tried publishing. Oh, how do you do that? So that's what I want to ask. How do you do that? How do you do it? What does it involve? Is it hard? Is it easy? Does it depend how good a writer it is that you are? Does it depend who you know? What is involved in getting trad published?
I'm telling you from day dot, all of those things are important. Yes, it is a very difficult thing to be traditionally printed. It's very competitive. There's a lot of people out there who've written manuscripts, whether they've written them well or whether they've written them not very well. I know before I did the journey of Rockstar, I tried the traditional route, but not in a committed way. So what I did was I had it edited by two different people and I got two different lots of feedback. One person said, you know, you need to lose the rhyme and just write it as a story. And another person said something about, well, I can't remember, but they were two completely different directions. So one was telling me to go one way and the other one was telling me to go somewhere completely different. And in the end, I had to kind of listen to my own instincts and say, no, I kind of love the story the way that it is and I'm going to back it the way that it is. So I sort of did that. If you're an aspiring author, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to be doing. So you need to make sure that, firstly, you've honed your craft really, really well. So you don't want to be presenting or submitting a piece of material that hasn't, A, been edited by someone, B, potentially looked at through a group, say, for example, an FB group that gives you feedback and stuff like that, a writing group, things like that. Hone your craft, get your manuscript absolutely, absolutely right. Go to as many KidLit events as you possibly can. Get to know the people, insiders. Get in front of their faces if you can. Introduce yourself where you can. And then do some online assessments, because the reality is if you can get in front of, like, KidLit Vic and CYA are two really great organisations for that, because you can get in front of real publishers and you can show them your work and you can do a pitch and they will give you real-time feedback on what they think works, what they don't think works, where you should be, you know, focused on. And then if they think that your manuscript has got legs, they may invite you to submit. It's a numbers game, really. So even if you don't do any of the KidLit and CYA stuff and you are lucky enough to get an agent, the agent will work on your behalf. If not, then it's you sending emails to as many submissions and getting into as many submissions as you can. Like, publishers all over Australia have got different submission dates all the time. I think Larrikin House on the 1st of March had their submission date. I think Affirm Press Monday, 2 days ago, had theirs. Publishers have always got submission dates open, so you just need to be on the ball and just keep submitting if you really feel strongly about what you're doing.
Yeah, and is concept important too, yeah, like the concept of the story?
James Layton, and I quote, says, concept is king. And he's absolutely right. concept is king, but also, again, it depends on what you're writing. Like, because primarily our focus is picture books, we've only just started coming into junior fiction. It's really important to have strong characters. It's really important to have a really strong character, like a story arc. It's really important to get very clear about what the buy-in is for the kid who's reading it. Is there a lot of engagement? Is there some funny stuff? Is it a bit quirky? Is it a bit silly? Like, we don't focus on stories that have got kind of didactic messages. We kind of move away from that. We produce books for pleasure, really, books that engage little kids and want them to kind of keep reading over and over again. It's not about sort of delivering a message about get off your screens or whatever. It's about, are you enjoying what you're reading and can we read it again? That's kind of what the outtake is. So, yeah.
I hear that a lot. I hear that so much. And I get that advice on this podcast constantly from all sorts of different professionals in the industry. They all say the same thing. Like, they hate books where the message is like right in your face. Middle-aged women, which I'm including myself in that, you know, we love to teach a lesson. You know, like, that's often why we write, and often what I call silly boy authors just write the funniest, fun, cool stuff. And I'm like, how come they get away with doing that?
I'm not interested in teaching anyone anything. No, I said this the other day. I think I'm probably going to become known for the quirky animal lady stories.
Yeah, so it must be this deep need in a lot of authors to want to shape young people. They want to teach them lessons or give them morals. Or I think it's sort of inherent that that's a lot of the time where someone will sit down and in particular choose to write a story for a child versus, say, writing smutty romance or something. Do you know what I mean? They tend to think that, like, if you're writing for a child, that's why you're writing for a child. And I probably fell into that early on too. I'm still learning to get myself out of that, I confess. But I love hearing this over and over again. Just get kids reading. Entertain them.
Look, there's nothing wrong with smut. Let me just put that out there.
You've secretly written a smutty romance, haven't you, Mary? It's self-published right now.
I have. I've written many, many pieces of smut, but I'm not sure that I would ever have them published, but it is what it is. To answer your question, I think it's not that it's an unfortunate thing, and it might be a very unpopular opinion, but I think what happens is, as women, because we're nurturers, and when we have children and we start to contemplate the idea of becoming a writer or an author, you start to recognize the things in your child that you want to help them with. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we look at the world in a really different way when we've had children. So what happens is that we start to recognize those things that might be affecting our child or where our child is struggling. And then we kind of start to think, okay, well, if I was going to address that, how would I address it? Yeah. And intuitively we go straight into the, I'm not going to say soppy stuff, the emotive, the deep, the stuff. I mean, look, I remember when Luke was really little, the books that touched me the most were the ones that made me cry. So there was some stories. R.H. Reynolds was an illustrator, and I can't think of the lady that did it, but she wrote a book called Someday, and it was this idea of watching your child grow and then leave you when they get older. And every time I read it, it just made me cry. And there's room for all of those stories. Absolutely, there's room for those stories. But I think in terms of developing an avid reader and engaging a child who loves reading for the sake of reading, you have to capture their imagination. I mean, there's a reason why Harry Potter has done so well. There's no real, I mean, yes, there's an underlying message, but you have to really look for it, yeah? And I think that's the thing. If you can't engage a child and you can't keep their attention, well, one of the things that was really interesting, because I've had an opportunity to speak to a lot of librarians, having started doing author visits and things, and the things that they say is, we give them a selection of different things so that they can, like, move towards the stuff that interests them. I don't care if they're reading a comic book. I don't care if they're reading a book about sport. What I care about is that they've got a book in front of them, they're actually sitting down and they're reading. So, you know, if you can find the thing that creates joy in your child and then you can find books that are reflective of that particular joy, then that's a really good way of engaging your child and giving them an opportunity to fall in love.
Yeah, and what I heard you say just then, though you may not know you said it, what I heard you say just then is you love that book, for example, the one that made you cry. So you love books that make you feel things. And I've actually read that, like, somewhere. I think it was someone, Stein, a famous writer, amazing, his books, Stein is his surname. But he talks a lot in his books about you have to make the reader feel something, and that's the key. Whether they're feeling funny and elated and lifted up or sad, but it's the feeling that you're trying to create.
You're absolutely wanting to create a visceral response, whatever it is, whether it's, yeah, whether it's joy, whether it's sadness, whether it's fear, whatever it is, depending on what your genre is. Larrikin House, our visceral response is laugh out loud, and that's what it is. If a manuscript doesn't land on James's desk and make him laugh out loud, it won't get signed. It's just that simple.
All right, anybody who wants to put in a submission to Larrikin House, you better go get that tested from kids if they haven't laughed out loud.
It's true, and the quirkier the better. He's got a very wicked and strange sense of humour, so the quirkier the better, the funnier the better, the more outrageous the better. So
the market's, like, still loves funny, huh? Like,
well, yeah, there's a market for everything. As I said to you before, there's a market for those beautiful, soft, intuitive stories. The CBCA Notables list this year will show you a beautiful variety of books that are out there in different genres, right? So, yes, there's room for soft, beautiful books and books with themes and books that just make you laugh. So yeah, we've done a couple of those ourselves, to be totally honest. I mean, My Shadow is Pink and My Shadow is Purple. Both of those stories, there's nothing funny about them, but they are beautiful, emotive, gorgeously written, beautifully illustrated books.
So coming back to the branding of an author, sorry to keep picking your brain and bringing you back here, but coming back to that branding, for example, if you're a funny author, let's say, it doesn't mean you can't write other stuff, but let's imagine that's a core part of who you are, that sort of needs to come across too, right? So there was this one author I knew who, I'd read some of this author's books, and then when I watched videos of this author, I was like, that can't be the author. That's not the author. Because the books were quite sort of dark, and then the author was in this beautiful white house with this very sort of like, welcome to reading time. And I was like, oh, I don't know, there was just an incongruency in my brain.
I don't know, but that welcome to reading time sounds a bit dark to me, mate.
I do love this author dearly, but there was an incongruency of that branding. It was sort of like I couldn't imagine the kids that read those sort of books sitting there and listening to her read the story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally get it. It's interesting because I did a masterclass. I don't know if you know that, you know, online site masterclass. And
oh, yes, yes.
And I did the R.L. Stein one, and it's a classic. He exemplifies his brand because even in his delivery, the way that he speaks, he's like kind of monotone and a sort of like, you know. So we know that all of his Goosebumps stories and things like that are all horror stories and paranormal and things. So it kind of works really well for him to be that sort of monotone, you know, that guy. But, yes, I think it's really important to be able to personify your brand, I call it, to be able to kind of show people who you are and to give them an indication of the sort of writing style. Now, the truth is that can be a little bit difficult if you're writing across different genres, right? So, like, if you looked at my social media, you wouldn't know right now, you'll see Jimmy Bottoms everywhere, so you'll just think that I'm the fart book lady, right? Which I'm not. I didn't mean to write a fart book. It just kind of happened that way. But
I love that a girl wrote a fart book, though. That's brilliant. High five. Double high five. Yes. I'm real. This is one of my, I think this is going to be one of my platform podiums, that I want girl silly authors. Maybe because I'm a silly author, I don't know. But I want more of them. I want to be allowed to be the naughty girl too. Not just
oh, well, I love that. Yeah, well, then you and I are going to get on really well. That just kind of happened. It happened like that. But if you looked at my social media, you see me. Yeah? You see me. You see what I like. You see what I'm into. You see what inspires me. You see the things that, you know, and even the stuff that's dark. You'll see the stuff that that doesn't make me happy. You'll see the stuff that, you know, I get upset about. It's really important to be people banter the word authentic around, right? But I kind of don't like that word. I'd rather that I say real. So I try to be as real as I possibly can so that when people meet me, they don't get shocked. Like you just said, they don't go, oh, my God, who's that? Like, what? And the thing is, what most people don't know about me, and social media is, it triggers me sometimes, but what most people don't know about me is that I'm innately shy. So if I walk into a room full of people that I don't know, 9 times out of 10, I'll probably stand back in the corner and wait till somebody approaches me because I'm very shy. Yeah, it's not until I actually get to know people that this comes out.
I would not have known that about you.
Well, because you've known me for how long, right? You've known me for a very long time. But those people that don't know me might think that I'm a bit standoffish until they start chatting to me and then they go, oh, yeah, okay, there she is. Yeah, now I can't shut her up. Okay, moving away now.
Yeah, right. So, but you're right, like, I think from what I'm hearing you say is that even though, you know, you don't go on your social media and go like, farts, farts, like 24-7, but you're showing all the different aspects of yourself. So when I see that fart book, I don't go, oh, that's not consistent with who she is. Because it does, I feel that does come through in your sense of humour in other posts. You know, yeah. Like it still melds in.
Well, yeah, I'm a bit of an idiot, really. So I kind of pride myself on being a bit unfiltered, bit of an idiot. I'm just going to tell you about what I think. I'm not backwards about coming forwards. I just, like I said, I say it how it is. If something isn't working for me, I'm going to say it. I'm not going to use my social media platform to pretend to be somebody that I'm not because I'm not built that way. So, yeah, I just be real. It's like, just be real. Be real and be true to what you're writing.
Yeah, I used to get really offended when people used to constantly go, gee, you're quirky. Gee, your character's quirky. And I'm like, no, they're not. They're normal. They're not quirky. They're normal. And one day I went, okay.
But what's wrong with quirky?
I don't know. Like, I used to just find it, just something about it used to make me go, oh, they can tell that I'm not. You know, like square.
I'm sorry. But why do you, like, seriously? I don't want to be normal. No thanks. No way. Weird. I'm a limited edition, buddy.
I'm sure it's a childhood thing. And, you know, as probably. I often say on this podcast, I do need lots of hours of extensive counselling. But I was a psychologist, and I also have a theory that psychologists need the most counselling of all.
Absolutely. I would absolutely agree with you. But I tell people, if you think I'm weird, just remember I'm a limited edition.
Maybe I should call this podcast How to Be a Limited Edition. Actually, that works.
Yeah, there's a word for you.
Literally, that's what I'm hearing from you the whole way through. It's be a limited edition. Be yourself. Work on your craft. Work on presenting yourself on lots of different platforms as yourself and just go out and be you and things will happen for you. Maybe we'll end up all working at Larrick and House and have 3 books published. Who knows? Or 6 now for you, is it? Whatever. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, there isn't anyone, like Dr. Zeus said it best, there is no one more you-er than you, right? And that's the absolute truth. There isn't anyone out there who can do what you do. There are a lot of people that write stories. There are a lot of people that think that they're authors. There are a lot of people that, you know, have written a manuscript and think that it's the best thing that has ever been written. And all of that is true for you because that's who you are. It comes down to how determined you are to make whatever dream it is that you've got in your head come true. And sometimes that means a lot of hard work, and sometimes it means developing really thick skin, because sometimes we get in our own way because we think that what we've written is just pure gold, right? And the truth is, it isn't always. And the truth is, it isn't commercially viable, and a publisher isn't going to publish it. Just because you think it's great doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, got legs or it's commercially viable or whatever. You have to be open to hearing what a professional is saying to you and being open to reworking something based on the critique or the feedback that's being provided by someone who knows what they're doing.
That's really good that you said that at the end, because it can be misconstrued often that people go like, I'm just being me and this story is totally me. And if you're rejecting a story, you're rejecting me. So you still have to prove at your profession. You know, my son's becoming an actor. I say to him all the time, I'm like, you have to go and do training. Like, if you're becoming an architect, you have to go and do training. But people tend to think that creative arts people just like turn up and do the job. You have to get the training. And it's the same with writing. So yes, be yourself, but listen to the critique and the experts to become a better version of yourself.
Yeah, I think if you spend your whole life taking everything personally, then there's no room for growth. If you are really attached to your own idea, there's no room for growth. I learned a long time ago, one of my marketing mentors taught me a long time ago, learn which fights are worth fighting, because there's no point, you know, beating a dead horse. I'll give you a very quick example. I remember, I'm not going to name any names, but I remember during a CYA or a kid lit assessment, two years in a row, a particular author came along and presented exactly the same story three times. And three times she presented them to me and another publishing company. And three times we told her the same thing. And the third time I said to her, look, I'm not sure whether or not you remember, but you actually presented the same story to us 2 years running and we gave you the same feedback. And she said, no, I didn't. No, I just kind of went, yeah, you're clearly attached to this story, you know, being the way that it is and not interested necessarily in kind of evolving it. So yeah, we can only provide you with as much information as we can in terms of feedback, and it's up to you then to kind of decide what you want to do with it. And then, you know, in that instance, you then say to people, okay, well, if you feel that strongly about it, then self-publishing might be an opportunity. You know what I mean?
But at the end of the day, having said that, a lot of self-published people complain that they've done all the marketing things and they still can't sell their book. I've got like six different series at the moment, and I can see now one of my series, for example, I don't have to do hardly any marketing and it just sells because it's written a certain way. So one of the other ones, I have to like put 50,000 years of effort and I've sold 10 copies, right? So sometimes your marketing is reflecting the quality of what you've written.
Absolutely. If you can't sell a book and you've self-published, there's got to be a reason for it. And, you know, I mean, I don't know, I would imagine that you had better readers look at your manuscript before you self-published and you had other people, you know, looking at it and giving you critique and feedback and doing all that sort of stuff. I think that's probably something that a lot of self-published authors don't do. That's the step that they miss, right? So they'll write something they think is fantastic. If you're lucky, they'll get it edited by, you know, a professional editor, but they're not likely to run it through some better readers or, you know, get responses from people that are specific to their target audience so that they can, you know, improve it and produce the best possible book. People talk about 50 Shades as a classic example for that. The books came out and then the movie came out, and all of a sudden there was this huge influx, and people were reading the book and going, oh my God, there's so many grammatical errors in this. Oh my God, it's so badly written. And oh my God, it's, you know, no disrespect, but it's a classic example of a self-published book that didn't go through the processes but did really well because of, you know.
Concept. Concept. Yeah. Okay, two more questions because our time is up. Two more questions. Your series, like the rock stars and the movie stars and the ones I'm talking about, those three. When they got picked up,
yes,
did they need more editing or were they already perfect?
They were not edited at all.
So they were already perfect. So you were already a nerd good writer.
Well, no, I can't.
That's why I asked that.
Like I said to you, I've been writing for 35 years, right? I write commercial copy. It's just what I do. It might not sound like that in terms of the way that I speak. But from a professional point of view, I actually know how to write. I had never written children's books before, but I did tell you earlier that a lot of my writing process is almost a download from somewhere else, right? And I know that you understand what I'm saying when I say that, but it's like a portal opens up in the top of my head and all of a sudden there's this dump and there's, you know, an hour later there's a story. And I will then either tweak it or refine it or whatever. So Movie Star and Rockstar were signed and they were produced relatively unscathed. About a year and a half later or 2 years later when I was asked to write Sports Star because I had three signed and the next one was due, I wrote it and the publisher, James, decided that he wanted to include some, you know, famous names in the book. So he wanted to include Ash Barty. He wanted to include, you know, the Opals. He wanted to have some sort of, you know, reference to high-profile people within. So I had to go back in and play with that from an editing point of view. That was the only editing. As far as Jimmy Bottoms and the other two that are coming out this year, no one's asked me to edit anything. There's been maybe one or two minor things where I've maybe used a word, oh, Okay. So there's one book that I've just, one manuscript that I've just submitted to my agent, and it's called Elephant, Totally Fabulous. And it's about an elephant who's like a body positive elephant. Originally, it was called Fat and Fabulous, as in PHAT, as in, you know. And they came back to me and they said, yeah, I don't know that you can use that word because there's going to be a lot of kickback. People don't necessarily, they'll think that it's the other word and we don't want to necessarily align ourselves with that. So I had to change that word, for example, but that wasn't a huge deal. So, yeah, no, I haven't really had any major structural edits, but then I haven't tried to write junior fiction, right? So if I tried junior fic, I would probably have red marks right through the manuscript on every page. Like, yeah, can you change these? Yeah, don't swear here and, you know.
Oh, so still I knew it. I had a feeling that you definitely didn't have them edited, that they were already perfect. Last question. In your bio, I read the word, and I don't know what it means, pluviophile. What is a pluviophile?
Are you Greek?
Yes, I am. Is this embarrassment? Is it a Greek word that was turned into an English word that I should know?
It's a lover of rain.
Is it?
Yes, a lover of rain. Pluviophile is a lover of rain.
Gosh, I did not know this. A lover of rain.
It's a beautiful word, isn't it?
So you really do love rain.
Yeah, give me rain on. Yeah, I hate, mate, I am the worst Greek in the world. Don't give me heat. Don't give me sunshine. Give me rain and darkness and thunder and clouds and a nice fireplace and I'm good.
Well, you belong in Melbourne then, so that's perfect.
That's exactly where I am. Although the sun is shining outside, I'm very disappointed with Shenzhen.
Thank you, Mary, so much for sharing all your knowledge and expertise. I have learned so much yet again. I've got to add to my to-do list of getting my brand out there 100% and make my books funnier 100%. So thank you so, so much. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for having me.
The links to you will be in the show notes and also to Larrikin House if anybody wants to go and check that out, and also to your book specifically. Thank you again so much for being
here. Thank you so much for having me. It was so nice to play with you again today.
Did you find that interview valuable? Great! Now be an awesome human and go and leave a review because it helps the podcast out so much. Want to read the show notes? Check out thechildrensbookauthorpodcast.com. Want to find out more about me, Eleanor Page? Find me at eleanorpage.com or come and say hello on social at Eleanor Page Books. Until next time, keep writing and keep learning.